I'm going to invite Susan, Barbara.
Yeah, I can. This seems extremely bizarre to me that I'm sitting here with everybody 20 years after the founding of this monastery, and I have so much gratitude. Thank you all, and thank you for inviting me to come back. I appreciate Mark's recounting of our early days, and I was in the late 90s in San Francisco dealing with, actually it was the late 80s, dealing with the deaths, the impending deaths of many, many of my friends as I had arrived in the Bay Area in the early 80s, just about 10 minutes after the HIV virus arrived. And in my late 20s, found myself in a situation that I was completely unprepared for and had no idea how to navigate. And that was finding myself with almost a dozen of my friends dying and nobody having any instructions on how to manage that. And through a series of grace is all I can really... All I can say is how that happened. But I landed at a Stephen Levine talk one evening, and walked out of that room. A friend of mine who was a Christian monk dragged me to that, thinking it would be something I would really enjoy since my friends were dying. And I thought that was a little odd because I was trying to avoid the death thing as much as possible. But at the end of that meeting, my Christian monk friend Marcel asked me what I thought of that, and I said, I don't understand a word that man said. I'm from New York, and we just don't talk about living in our heart or opening up our, softening our belly or any of the things that we were being led to do that evening. So I went home that evening and probably had a beer or whatever I did in those days to deal with my suffering. And about a month later, I was at the bedside of my friend who was in fact dying. And I was holding his hand like a vice grip and I had no idea what to do. And I just sat next to him. And at the time, I was working at the stock market. And so this ticker tape came across what was left of my mind saying, you can soften your belly and you can keep your heart open even in hell. And I realized, oh my God, that's that guy, Stephen Levine. So I didn't have any better ideas of what to do in that moment. So I did those two things and had the most amazing sort of meditation with my friend. He had been in a coma for the better part of the week. And we were... I can't even explain where we were, but we were very connected and somewhere else. And somebody came in downstairs and slammed the front door. And I was like, Jeff and I were back in that moment. And he opened his eyes for the first time in days. We were like, oh my God. And I thought, something here is working. So a couple of months later, I was working then. I'd left the stock market and went to work with a gentleman named Daniel Barnes, who was working with Stephen and Andrea Levine. And for all the people that are here today, there's some people that are not. And Daniel Barnes was instrumental in us being together at the beginning. And Daniel invited me to a talk that was being given. It's what was Spirit Rock, which was just a large piece of property that they had rented a tent for the talk. And it was a group of Christian monks and some Buddhist monks. And I was thinking this would be a great opportunity for me to regain my connection to my Catholic background. And I went for it wholeheartedly, except I left that day not caring at all so much about my Catholic background, but sort of infatuated by the Theravadan monastic community. And Daniel was quadriplegic, he still is, and asked me, I was catering at the time, and he asked me if I would be willing to cater the meal or offer a meal for the monastics if they were to come to his apartment where we were working. And I said, yes, I'd be happy to do that. And that was the first time I believe I met Debbie Stamp. And she was trying to coach me on how to offer the meal. And for me, it was like three courses. So we need to have three courses served. And this eating out of a bowl was not okay with me. And so trying to organize Daniel's kitchen to feed, I don't know, there was probably 20 people there with all the plates we'd need. And bless their hearts, Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Amar went along with that. And the following weekend was... a board meeting, and Daniel was attending that, and I suggested that I could offer the meal, since then the board could just meet together. We met at Mark Lieberman's house at 10 Arbor Street in San Francisco. And that was the closest I'd really ever been to Buddhist monks, and I really was very didn't know what to do or how to behave. So I just made the best food I could possibly make. And they put the food out to serve during a break at the board meeting and invited me to sit down and eat with the Sangapala members. And during that lunch, the phone rang, and I think Nancy, Mark's wife, came back and let us know that one of the board members had to resign. She had something going on with her family that precluded her from continuing her relationship on the board. And we continued to eat in silence for several minutes, and Ajahn Sumedho then looked up and looked down at me, who was as far away as possible, and said, "Susan, would you consider being on the Sangapala board with us?" And I was just face in my bowl. I was just eating and pretending I wasn't there. And I looked up at him and I just said no. So Ajahn Sumedho continued to eat again for a few minutes in silence. And everybody, I thought, oh, good, now they're going to forget I'm here. And I just was like, oh, my God, let this be over. Let the earth, the big one, maybe this would be perfect for the big one to happen right now. And so a minute or two later, Ajahn Sumedho cleared his throat again and just said, "Why not?" And I thought about it for a minute and I said, well, I have never been on a board of anything before and I don't really know what to do about that. And I'm not a Buddhist. So he went back to eating. And I went back to eating. And several minutes later, he looked up at me again and said, "We can work with that." So here we are, 27 years later. And I spent 7 years. We had a virtual vihara going where Ajahn Amaro would come every summer with a monk or a lay person, and we would be either at Duncan Street or at Mark's house. And then we graduated kind of up the coast. We went up with a 101. We went to Novato and then Bell Springs Road up in Laytonville. And we started doing retreats, and somehow, bless Debbie Stamp's heart, who's out there, Dob, Ajahn Sumedho suggested that Debbie Stamp and I co-manage a retreat. And I think that was only because I had gone on a 17-day retreat the year prior, and the silence part, not so good at that. So he said, "Why don't you manage this?" And I said, "That would be great, because then I could talk to people if I needed to." So Debbie and I managed several of the retreats at the City of 10,000 Buddhas, and continued to support the monastic the monks that were coming during the summer. And then eventually we were at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. And I remember this so clearly because for some reason, Ajahn Sumedho and I spent about 5 Father's Days together. And it was a tradition in our family for Father's Day to buy your father a tie. And I just started buying Ajahn Sumedho ties for Father's Day. And this was, I think, one of the first times this happened. And so we were at the City of 10,000 Buddhas, and Debbie Stamp and I were there. And I can't remember the monk's name from Italy, but he had also joined us that summer. And, yes, Tanavaro. And so we were sitting in the room waiting for Skip, the real estate agent, to come over. And I offered Ajahn Sumedho his Father's Day gift, and he put it on. He looked great in a tie. And Skip came in with a tie also, and I'll never forget the difference because Ajahn Sumedho's tie was so long with his robes, and Skip's tie came up to like here. And they went off, and they came here to this land that Master Hua had offered. And there was, I think, 125 acres of poison oak, a small house, and somebody had slashed through what was a road. And the monastery was established, and it was just a remarkable thing. I pretty much opted out of the board at that point because it was time for other people to participate. But those 7 years were integral in both my ability to manage those deaths of friends and people whose hearts and minds were so connected to mine, and to find a community of people, including the nuns. And Sister Sundra was one of the first nuns that I met, and we have been fast friends ever since, though we rarely see each other. It was just such an amazing opportunity to meet people that I would never, ever have met. And I would have to guess that I just am so grateful for the patience. I was not, if there is a typical type of Buddhist person that comes to a monastery, I was not it. And at Abhayagiri and at Amaravati, they were extremely patient with my I loved the Christian monk that was just talking, because I'm like, I'm your people. Sort of the dirty kind of rolling around in it. And I just loved that he spoke, because the reason that I met this whole community was because I went to find my Christian roots. And to have him here speaking just moments before I was going to speak was really beautiful for me. To see so many people's lives be enriched by those crazy, crazy meetings we would have at Mark's house. We would be arguing, like you would think, like we were in divorce court or something some of those days. And it was a group of people, the combination, somehow we ended up landing like incredibly grounded, but like with aspirations that shot to the sky. And this is the result of that. And I have to say, I haven't been here in 10 years. I don't want to spoil them, but I've only come in the last 10 years for the 10-year anniversary, and then here, and I'm just stunned. I'm just stunned at the growth and the amount of monastics that have been able to ordain here, and the amount of lay people that have been able to come and hear the Dharma and be in a community together. And there is just something that it just makes me want to cry, and I'm almost speechless, but not quite. So, thank you all. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. It's lovely.